Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Jobs, Apple, and Waffle House. In pretty much that order, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 6th of March. Glad to have you with us, everybody. You know who else is here? John Carney from The Wall Street Journal is here. Also, Neela Richardson from Redfin. He's in New York. She's in Washington. It's a little thing we call our weekly wrap. Goes, I don't know, about 4 minutes. Covers the last 5 days in the global economy. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
All right, John, we start with you and the jobs number today. 295,000 new jobs in the economy last month. The rate falls to 5.5%. Other than stuck wage growth, which has been the through line for a long time, any bad news in here?
No. This is fantastic news. The markets didn't like it because they say they think it means interest rates are going up faster. That's a kind of dumb response. If the economy is doing really well, that's really great news. We've had the longest and greatest job creation over the last 6 months than any period since 2000. This is really, really great. We're pretty close to full employment. Remember just a couple of years ago, we thought we'd never get there again. We thought, you know, oh, we'll never get back down to 5% unemployment. We're at 5.5.
So, Neela, very quickly, any bad news for you in this?
No, it's mainly good news. What's the problem is that wage growth, it's not going to grow because monetary stimulus can't do it by itself.
Right, exactly. All right, so we're going to get to interest rates. There are two parts of it I want to talk about. One, John, what's your sense of timing from the Fed now on when rates are going to go up? Sooner rather than later?
I still think it's not till probably September.
Ooh.
There's no rush to raise them because we're not seeing any kind of inflation. So I think they want to make sure that the growth is robust and stays in place before they start raising.
Neela, same question to you. When do you think they're going to raise?
I think it'll be in the middle of the year. I think it'll be before September, still in June. We're on pace. We're on track to do this now, rather than later.
Fair enough. The other thing I want to talk about interest rates. So as you guys know, the 2009 transcripts of Federal Reserve meetings came out earlier this week. In there somewhere, in the March 2009 meeting, there was a line from Janet Yellen, then the head of the San Francisco Fed, now, as we all know, the head of the whole shebang. She said, you know what, Mr. Chairman, talking to Ben Bernanke, things are so bad in this economy that if we could, we should lower our interest rates to minus 6%. That's astounding, John. It leads me to believe that things were way worse than we thought they were.
I think that's absolutely right. The natural rate of interest at that point was very, very low. And we heard a lot of people complaining that the Fed was holding down interest rates or making them artificially low. This should clear that up. Things were not artificially low. In fact, they were artificially high.
Neela, zero was too high. So, Neela, what about that? 0% interest was too high.
Well, you know what? It's because the Fed has basically had to go at it alone. In 2009, there was another big stimulus action on the fiscal side, $800 billion, that petered out within the first year. It always took both monetary and fiscal policy. We only saw one over the past 6 years. And that's why wages haven't grown. And that's why this monetary policy, this stimulus, has been controversial in terms of its effect on the real economy.
John, very quickly, I want to touch on the bank stress tests. They came out yesterday. In theory, the banks have a clean bill of health, but is it truly clean?
Well, quite a few of them did worse this time around than last year. But that's more of an artifact of how they run the tests rather than the fact that the banks are getting weaker. The main thing you can't do, but everybody tries anyway, is to try to predict the second stage of the stress test from the fact that they passed this one. There are so many unknowns about what goes into the second stage of the stress test that is a fool's errand and people just shouldn't do it.
but of course they will, Neela. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
And John's right, because the second part is the best part. That's when the banks learn when they can actually return capital back to the shareholders. Right. That's what Wall Street is waiting for, and that is really the whole point of this thing for the banks.
And that comes out next week, Thursday, I think. John Carney from The Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson from Redfin. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai. Have a good weekend.
You too. There are, as John was saying, few things Wall Street likes less than the prospect of rising interest rates, which doesn't kind of make much sense. But I'm guessing it's going to be the wah-wah trombones when we get there. We all know, though, that I don't control the music around here. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is, I think, an apt time for the following reminder. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the economy, and the economy is not the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The Dow is, however, a not-too-terrible indicator of some of the things that are happening in the economy, some of the ways it's changing. Case in point, the news this morning that come close of business on March 18th, Apple will be in as one of the 30 blue chips in the Dow, and AT&T will be out. Do not run off to call your broker. This isn't going to be a big deal equities-wise. But as I said, it is a sign of a sea change in the American economy. Stan Alcorn explains how we got here.
In this era of big data and automated trading, the 30 companies that make up the Dow are picked by five human beings, led by Dow Jones Index Committee Chairman David Blitzer.
We sit down in a room for about an hour and a half around a conference table, a little coffee, no cookies.
The process isn't exactly scientific, but they do try to keep the index representative of American industry. A little tech, a little manufacturing, a little oil and gas. But because the Dow is really just an average of 30 stock prices, one company's share price can throw the whole thing out of whack. In this case, Visa did a four-way split, which dramatically reduced its share price. And because Visa is considered a tech company, the Dow needed to add more tech.
Apple is everybody's obvious choice. Nobody even thought about arguing against Apple.
It's a sign of the times.
Jim Angel is a professor of finance at Georgetown University.
It basically shows the rise of Apple and the iCompany, as I call it. And this also shows that the new AT&T is not nearly as dominant as the old AT&T was.
And the Dow already has Verizon. Apple, on the other hand?
I would say Apple is sort of in a class by itself.
Roger Kay is president of Endpoint Technologies Associates. He says Apple stands out not just as the world's largest company, but as a tech company with a track record of selling tangible products.
So why not Google, you know? But then you could sort of start adding, I suppose, almost anybody, Facebook and Twitter. I mean, I think a company has to prove that it's going to be around for a while.
Microsoft and Intel both cleared that bar. But, note to Tim Cook, after becoming part of the Dow, their performance was weak for years. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Stand by the way, for that watch coming Monday, probably from Apple. There was yet another oil train disaster yesterday. Galena, Illinois, this time. 21 cars carrying crude from North Dakota came off the rails. Five or so are still burning today. No injuries or water pollution reported. Not this time, but the run of accidents is turning up the pressure on federal regulators who are writing new rules for trains in this American petroleum boom. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has that story.
99% of the time, a train delivers oil and no one notices. But with three incidents in 3 weeks and more oil spilled in a year than the past 35 combined, new rules are coming. Take the tank cars. Industry prefers a revamp model with the fancy name of CPC 1232, but that's the car that leaked the last two incidents, says analyst Kevin Book at Clearview Energy Partners.
The unjacketed 1232s seem increasingly likely to be part of the phase-out based on the recent events.
In other words, many of the current cars will have to go. New federal rules are due in May.
Often regulators pitch strict standards to the Office of Management and Budget at the White House, and OMB comes back and says, well, that's awfully expensive. Let's try to be pragmatic. That may be much harder to do now.
You might think environmental groups would be happy. Think again. Sean Dixon at the New York nonprofit Riverkeeper says several key issues are off the regulatory table. For instance, the accepted speed limit for oil trains is 40 miles per hour.
We've seen accident after accident happen at speeds below 40 miles an hour. Below 20 miles an hour in many cases.
There's no consideration of track safety, some complain, or bridge standards. No one asked all these questions until the oil boom of North Dakota. And now it's a complex issue with multiple stakeholders. But one thing is reasonably clear. A giant accident would not be fully covered by insurance, so the public would hold the financial bag. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There was a study in the journal Health Affairs a couple of years ago that put the annual costs of obesity in this country at $150 billion. Figure it's a bit more by now. Fully a third of Americans are obese, more than half are overweight, and the public health implications are enormous. With that perhaps in mind, the Food and Drug Administration has approved a new medical device that, in layman's terms, lets you turn hunger off. Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons reports.
If turning off hunger sounds like a mind trick, that's because it kind of is. Mark Knudsen is founder and president of Enteromedics, which makes the so-called stomach pacemaker. Knudsen says it all began when he realized controlling hunger is about much more than just stopping your stomach from rumbling. Think of it this way.
Can I go into a store and just buy the five items I want, or am I going to end up filling up my grocery cart and taking it all home?
Knudsen says it was about more than physically shrinking your stomach. That's what happens with bariatric surgery. Knudsen wanted to get at the source of that inclination to overeat. The result of years of research and development is what's known as V-block therapy. It stands for vagus block. The vagus is a nerve. The treatment involves surgery to implant a device that looks like a pacemaker. It sends electrical signals that diminish hunger. At Enteromedics headquarters in St. Paul, Minnesota, is 48-year-old Erica Roy Nyleen. She struggled with obesity and related health issues for decades. Diets and medication didn't work. When she heard an ad for a clinical trial for V-block therapy, she signed up.
It was an unknown, and so the one thing I said to myself is, I will not go backwards. I will not gain weight on this thing. So that's sort of been, you know, my lowest goal this whole time.
In the first year, with the help of a diet coach, she lost 5 pounds. She was sure things were going right.
After a little bit over a year, they told me that it wasn't a real one.
Turns out she was in the placebo group. So they went back and turned it on.
It's just night and day. I couldn't believe that sense of fullness and sense of satisfaction that I was done eating. I really thought through, I don't think I've ever really had that feeling.
In the year since that happened, she's lost 30 pounds. That's half of her total goal. She's thinking about stopping her blood pressure medication. All from a little device that zaps the vagus nerve and that somehow tells your brain you're not hungry. Enteromedics says the device will cost between $10,000 and $15,000, and that doesn't include the costs of surgery or follow-up. So even if it does turn out to be a silver bullet, who's going to pay for it? Melissa Martinson is president of Technomics Research, a health economics consulting firm.
A lot of times insurance companies will claim that they don't consider cost when they make coverage decisions, but most health economists and most people who work in the field don't think that that's literally true.
She says insurers weigh efficacy against cost and safety before covering a new treatment, but that can encourage a conservative approach to approving new devices. Defibrillating pacemakers faced similar hurdles, but today they're common. Since many Americans are obese and also have a related health condition, the potential market is huge. So insurers then have to think about how sustainable a treatment is.
People are losing weight all the time. They just can't sustain that weight loss. And we know that the types of therapies that are available need to be long-term.
William Dietz is director of the Redstone Center at George Washington University's Milken Institute of Public Health. He says reductions in obesity and other health problems mean reductions in costs to insurers. Just losing 5 to 10% of weight helps to start to reverse high blood pressure, diabetes, and other complications.
The problem is that I don't think that that's compelling enough for insurance companies, particularly since they're facing long-term costs, and that they're worried about relapse.
A real game changer would be an obesity treatment that avoids the yo-yo effect of weight loss and weight gain. It's not known if V-block therapy will be durable or if its effects will fade over time. Nevertheless, the FDA approved the device because it brought on a sizable decrease in weight with few side effects. But just because the FDA approved it doesn't mean insurance companies will too. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I don't care if you're talking, what celebrity chef you're talking about. Those line cooks could outcook any of them when it comes to speed and efficiency.
Oh, and they make a mean waffle, too. But first, let's do the numbers. There you go, the Wawas. I knew it. The Dow Industrials tumbled 278 points today, 1.5%, closed at 17,856. The Nasdaq shed 55 points, 1.1%, ended things at 49.27. The S&P 500 down 29 points, 1.4%, finished at 2,071. For the week, the Dow off 1.5%. The Nasdaq slipped 0.7%. The S&P 500 gave back 1.6%. Apple sweetened about 0.1% today. The company, as we told you, is replacing AT&T in the Dow. AT&T fell 1.5%. Bank of America bashed up 1.3% today after the bank's positive stress tests exceeded investor expectations, which I guess is a good thing. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose big, up to 2.24%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The Fed releases its labor market conditions index for the month of February. On this day in 1959, the first Barbie doll went on display at the American Toy Fair in New York City. And don't forget to move your clocks 1 hour ahead for daylight savings. Or do. You know, this just might be the perfect excuse to be late for work Monday morning. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Things change when the frackers come to town. There's heavy equipment all over the place, drilling rigs and the like. Sometimes there's a lot more money with leasing deals for mineral rights. There's also lots of debate over economic benefits versus environmental costs. It is a delicate and sometimes contentious balance in which there is money to be made by trying to keep the peace and quiet. From WCPN in Cleveland, Joanna Richards reports.
Carroll County in eastern Ohio was the original bird's eye for Utica shale gas development in the state. Trucks with Texas license plates now jam the roads alongside Amish buggies. Farmers are fixing up their houses as money from mineral leases rolls in. But for Frank Brothers, the price is too high.
As you can see, that's what's coming right at our door.
Even though their house sits on 21 forested acres, the Brothers family has been cooped up indoors with the windows closed since last March. That's when Blue Racer Midstream started the huge engines of its gas compressor station across the street. It's run pretty much 24/7 since. Brothers holds up a decibel meter at his front property line.
There you're hitting 87.
Compressors are needed about every 50 to 100 miles along pipelines to help move gas through them. They're always loud, but this situation is rare. Energy companies do usually shield the neighbors. And that's what's pushing what you might call a silent boom accompanying the oil and gas bonanza in noise abatement. Murray Stacy is VP of Shreveport-based Soundfighter Systems. He says the company got a ton of new business with development of the nearby Barnett Shale underlying Fort Worth, Texas.
Noise became a front burner issue for them because the sweet spot of the shale was literally underneath some of the more densely populated areas.
At the peak of Barnett development, Stacy says 80% of Soundfighter's business came from the shale gas industry. It's still about 60%. The demand for noise control in the Utica and Marcellus shales drew Canadian company Noise Solutions to open a branch in western Pennsylvania.
It was a growth of about 100%.
Business development engineer Tyler Mose shows me what his company can do. He leads me outside to a little building designed for loud equipment. One side is open, and another is walled off by a series of panels, a few inches thick and about 1.5 feet deep. From inside the building, it's like you're looking through open window blinds. The panels are made of perforated sheet metal and sound-absorbing insulation. Listen to how Moses' voice sounds standing next to me outside.
So this is a silencer for a cooler fan assembly that would be cooling the jacket water on a compressor driver.
Now listen to what he sounds like from inside the building, talking through the row of panels. So I can't hear him at all, really. I can watch his mouth moving, but I can't hear anything. I'm going to walk around. Tyler, could you just keep talking for a minute?
The noise that's produced from that inlet fan going to the driver.
That's impressive. That kind of technology can reduce compressor noise from this to this. That's from a compressor station like the one we heard earlier, blasting at the Brothers family's home. I taped the first clip inside the noise barrier building, and the second about 8 feet outside it. John Schnickenberg is principal engineer for Dominion East Ohio, which owns this station. He says the effect isn't cheap.
We're probably talking in excess of $250,000.
But that has bought much better relations with the neighbors. Even with low oil prices, professional noise fighters are confident. Sound regulations are tightening, and gas producers profit on volume, so they're always trying to move more gas faster. That means stronger and louder compressors. Noise Solutions CEO Scott McDonald says his role is to referee.
We help to ensure harmony between the industry and the community.
That doesn't guarantee communities will embrace oil and gas development, but it might lower the volume on a little part of the debate. In Cleveland, I'm Joanna Richards for Marketplace.
If you've driven the highways of the American South, you've seen them hard by an exit or on the outskirts of major cities. The Waffle House, a restaurant chain known for a particular brand of comfort food, served fast and cheap and 24/7. Sometimes, though, just eating there isn't enough. Andrew Knowlton is the restaurant and drinks editor for Bon Appetit magazine. He not too long ago took his longstanding relationship with that chain to a whole nother level by working the grill at a Waffle House near Atlanta for 24 straight hours. Andrew, it's good to have you on.
Nice to be here.
What inspired you, what possessed you to work at a Waffle House for 24 hours straight?
That's a good question. I've always had a love affair with the Waffle House growing up in Atlanta. And I was in Charleston, South Carolina, sitting at a Waffle House with my six-year-old daughter. And she was in this kind of stage where she was asking me if I had done various jobs. Have you ever been a basketball player? Have you ever been a preacher? And then she turned to me and said, have you ever been a Waffle House line cook? And I said, no, but that's a pretty good idea. So I went to Adam Rappaport, who's the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit, and I said, I got a good idea. I want to go work a shift as a grill operator at the Waffle House.
Yeah.
And he said, that's a horrible idea. How about you work 24 hours straight at a Waffle House? Because
that's a much better idea.
That's a much better idea.
You get there at 7 o'clock in the morning. They park you in front of the grill. And how does it go?
Not too well. You know, they started me off slowly on the waffles, which is kind of the beginner. It's kind of like the layup, if we're speaking in basketball terms. So I started doing layups, and I missed a few of those. I overcooked them, or sometimes the batter can get tricky. And then I slowly kind of worked my way over to the grill, which, you know, they would never put me on in the busy shift, like, you know, that 7 to 9 or the lunch hour. So I made some hash browns, and I was getting decent at putting a burger or doing one of their famous omelets as well. But it was a steep, steep learning curve.
They've got a whole system they use at Waffle House. So that I guess the theory is any line cook at a Waffle House can walk into any other one and step right in?
That's the thinking behind it, because they are transferring people from store to store so frequently. They have what they call the pull, drop, mark method, which pull means you pull the whatever meat product you're, you know, the customer. Drop means you're dropping hash browns. And then the real science is involved is when you mark. And the line cooks never see a ticket. It gets yelled out by the waiters. And then they take various packets of condiments, whether it's ketchup or grape jelly, and where they put that on the plate, whether it's at noon or at 3 o'clock or 6 o'clock, or whether it's turned upside down, immediately identifies what the plate is that the grill operator needs to cook. And I fumbled my way through that. You know, I knew that a butter packet on a plate upright was just a regular waffle. That is about as far as I got. But I would have to work there a month before I got it. I mean, yeah, I would rather go back and study Kierkegaard and Heidegger and Hegel than try to do that again.
You worked as a line cook in a fast food, diner-ish kind of place, working on the grill for 24 hours. What'd you learn?
I learned that it's probably the hardest job that I'll ever do. I learned that I don't care if you're talking, what celebrity chef you're talking about, those line cooks could outcook any of them when it comes to speed and efficiency. And I learned that at the end of the day, being a gentleman and being a professional cost you nothing. And I think that's the big lesson that I took away from the Waffle House is smile, have a good time. Most of the people coming through are good people. A few bad ones that come in, but that's kind of life anyway, and it's just how you roll with it.
What's your go-to when you go into the Waffle House to get something to eat?
Without a doubt, it's a patty melt, not with Texas toast, but with regular toast, and then hash browns covered, smothered, diced, and peppered.
I'm not even going to ask what that means. Andrew Knowlton is the restaurant and drinks editor at Bon Appetit. He worked at a Waffle House for 24 straight hours, wrote about it in the magazine. Andrew, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, a research paper from the Brookings Institution about how ISIS uses Twitter. There are, Brookings says, about 46,000 Twitter accounts out there being used by ISIS supporters, and they're pretty active, too. Those accounts had an average of 1,000 followers apiece, which is way, way higher than most non-ISIS-related Twitter users. They average about 100, maybe 200 on the high side.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
All right, it's quitting time. On the heels of that jobs report and fears of a rate rise, the Dow off 278 points today. That is 1.5%. The NASDAQ shed 55 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 dropped itself 29 points lower, 1.4%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Orr. Tommy Andres is the acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.